Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello.
And Ben Roy Turner.
Hello there.
How are both of you surviving this current video game drought?
It's difficult, man. I'm eating beans from the can. I'm playing games I've already played a billion times before. When's it going to end? Is there an end in sight?
Apparently, the exact time it's meant to end is, I think, March 20th when Doom arrives.
But so that's more than a month left.
Yeah, weeks away.
Have you ever seen E.T. when E.T. is literally dead in like a little stream? That's me at the moment. Just good. Sucked of all life, like, give me games.
Floating down, attempting to grab onto Sekiro. Sekiro bats you away, and you float back to Resident Evil yet again. We just thought we'd do a pod on all the stuff that we're sort of revisiting and playing at the minute, because it's a lovely time. We talked about this before we came in, but for me, this reminds me of, usually this only happens once a year when it's at Christmas, when the release calendar stops, and I can just get my life back, and I don't have to keep up with everything, and I can just go back to ridiculous toss like Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry, and I don't have to care about it, and I can just play whatever I want. I can nap whenever I want. And so I'm quite liking this. I'm liking this drought. But you guys were saying that you're itching for new stuff.
I'm starving. As Josh was saying, like, I've been playing, catching up with all these games. Oh, the backlog. Let's get the backlog done. Yeah, let's do that. Let's play Sekiro.
You didn't have to play Sekiro.
I did, because it was a challenge laid down to me, and I won. Just like I beat Celeste as well. I won.
Do really, things really... you enjoy. Stop playing games that you...
I played Bioshock. Apparently, I was going to enjoy that.
It's also not really winning if you use a guide, but carry on.
I mean, you know, if you want to spend hours and hours just batting someone away and dying, then it's fine.
I do. I'm a big FromSoft fan. But so you're going through Bioshock at the moment. We put down a little list of things that we're playing. I'm going to open the floor with Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry. Now, you put your collar up, JB.
Yeah, because it's feeling a bit icy in the studio, is all I'm saying. And I know we're going to get some opinions that I don't fully agree with, so I'm putting on the armor before we jump into this.
Nice, but wholesome podcast.
Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry, good.
It's the DLC for Assassin's Creed Black Flag, and I don't know why, but the other day I had the weirdest pang to go back to old school Assassin's Creed. And I just was going, what?
I want to make something clear to the audience. This was preceded by me talking to Scott and saying, I really want to play Assassin's Creed Odyssey. I haven't played that.
It wasn't
and
that.
You said, you're a madman. Don't do that. Why would you want to do that? And now you're going back to Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry.
No, because it felt, because there's something about Origins and Odyssey, more so Odyssey, that just feels like it's just content of the game. It's just stuff to do, things to do for like 200 hours. You don't really feel anything worthwhile. And I don't even mind Odyssey. I like Alexios. I like Cassandra. But I don't know. There's just something about those games that are just big and over
is
the top.
Is it because you know there's not going to be one of them this year, so you're like, oh, because like last year, me and Josh died on Days Gone. Assuming that.
Well, it's one of those
There's no
games,
big
right?
content game there this
Maybe.
Year.
Maybe. There was something about Assassin's Creed. I was just thinking back on Assassin's Creed, and part of me wants to buy the Assassin's Creed 3 remaster, but I'm not that insane. I'm probably going to buy it tonight, but I haven't got it yet.
And you'll get it.
I thought I might do it. And I thought I went back on my PS4 and I put Assassin's Creed in the search bar, and I already owned Freedom Cry and a bunch of other ones. And I thought, I've not finished Freedom Cry. I got it as the DLC for Black Flag. And so I went to that, and I know you play as Adewale, who's like the slave that you liberate as Edward Kenway in the main game. And then it's like years years later, and he's like got his own ship, and it's just all the different mechanics and everything that you know from Black Flag, done in like a 4-hour stint. Now, one, all games should be 4 hours. It's brilliant. Yes. You can get it done in an afternoon and feel really, really good.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but Karen.
What if Days Gone was 4 hours?
I mean, Days Gone should be 4 hours, but Days The Last done. Of Us 2, You'd if be The done. Last of Us 2 is 4 hours, I'm going to...
What if it's four brilliant hours, though?
I won't be.
Wow. I love this. This all games should be 4 hours gimmick is the same as all films should be 90 minutes.
Yeah, you brought this in. All movies should be an hour and a half long. It's mainly because you know you're going to get through it. I think that was one of the reasons, too, is that I looked up on howlongtobeat.com, and it was Freedom Cry was down as 4 hours, and I was like, I can do that in pretty much one sitting. But yeah, old school Assassin's Creed, considering how many features they, you know, would go on to put into those games, you know, there's enough there. There's enough. You can counter kill, you can go on these big killing sprees and stealth from the bushes and all that type stuff. And there's one big assassination that you do at the end, where my guy like ran away and I chased him around this village, and I eventually came out of nowhere and macheted him in the face, and it was great. I had a lovely little time.
Nice.
And I recommend it. I think it's a nice little story.
For me, all these Assassin's Creed games seem to be like those like gimmick burgers, like trying to one up each other. Like, let's put nachos in it this time. Let's just keep filling this burger up until you can't eat it with your hands anymore.
I wish they started calling them gimmick burgers.
Yeah.
Would you like a gimmick burger?
And it's just like, yeah, I don't know. Like,
it's the thing that kept me going is, and it's strange because you know, you have so many different archetypal video game enemies. Like, hey, it's some Nazis to kill. Hey, yeah. It's like some evil aliens or whatever. In Freedom Cry, you're literally liberating slave camps and plantations and stuff. And I just realized that I absolutely despise that whole idea of trying to, you know, keep people enslaved. So I was like, I'll totally take a machete to all these slave owners.
There's something satisfying about that. Yes. I remember playing Mass Effect 3, Mafia 3. Mm. And there's a point, there's a mini game, well, not a mini game, a side mission in that sequel, mm-hmm. where you have to go around the houses of these really rich people, and they're secretly KKK members, and they're having like not rallies in the back garden, but they're having meetings in their back garden. Right. So you sneak into the posh estate and you just like throw molotovs at them. And there's something so satisfying in having a proper reprehensible like enemy like that. Yuck. to just hit you in the gut and make you think, you know what, I want to brutally murder these people, and it's going to be satisfying.
It makes up the distance considering that in those games you are just doing the same thing over and over again. Like, I mean, like, you know, there's only like 9 acts to it, so there's 9 main missions to it. Everything else is all side stuff, and you can upgrade your ship, you can go, you have like a whole quarter of the map, like the overall map, to go and explore. It's a new area as well. You know, you can take your time going like to those different places, but I just found myself liberating everyone because there's like dynamic stuff in the village where, like, you know, you'll one of the slaves will run past you and like someone's trying to catch them, and you can kill that dude and be like, come join my ship, we're doing this Freedom Cry, come on board my Freedom Cry. And it's amazing.
Ben Roy said something very interesting earlier. That does sound a lot like why I really enjoyed Days Gone last year, because it's a content game. It's something that gives you enough motivation to jump in. But then the loop is just kind of satisfying. You can just keep doing it and keep doing it when there's nothing else that's, you know, pressing in the gaming world. Sometimes it's just nice to lose yourself in that almost malaise of gaming, you know, interaction.
That's, we should start calling them content games. That's genuinely really good.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, but it's what I like the most about these content games is when you don't have to do everything for the platinum like Days Gone. Mm. You just, I don't need to get all 7,000 things.
Collectible things.
I just need 2,000.
Josh, tell the world about, what was it, Pathologic 2?
Right, I love it. Well, I love this because I came in after Christmas and I was playing Pathologic 2. And you guys kept asking me what I was playing, and I kept saying, well, I'm playing Pathologic 2.
And said, what are you talking about, JB?
Well, none of you even questioned what it was. It was just like, all right, he's doing a thing. He's doing a little
he's
gimmick.
He's made up another game
He's made a game up.
Oh, was it on VR?
We don't want to talk about this, so just move on.
Yeah. No, I got this on Ben Roy's favorite Games Pass because I watched a video before Christmas from H. Bomber Guy, and it's really good. It's not about why the original Pathologic is awesome, but that game has came out about 10 years ago, has a lot of issues, and apparently number 2 was that version almost remade by the same developers, but as it should have been back then. So I jumped in it. It's a game about you play as this person who's coming back to his hometown after a long time away. He's a doctor, and a plague hits the town. And you have to try and figure out, you're on these day cycles. Each day you've got a new set of tasks. You have to get them done before the end finishes, all the while you're fighting hunger, reputation, sleep, and stuff like that. And it's one of the most punishing games I've ever played, but it's so reactive to what you do. Like, so many games get dialogue options wrong, whereas in this, you have to actually think about what you're saying and what people are saying. Otherwise, it impacts how quests play out. And it's not like spoon-fed to you, but it actually makes you think about what you're doing. Every sort of thing matters. Like, you're on a constant time limit, and just getting from point A to point B is like an act in itself. You spend so much time walking around, which sounds boring, but it's quite moody and introspective, and it's unlike anything else I've ever played. The problem is, it plays like arse on the Xbox. It's genuinely...
Well, frame rate wise.
Frame rate rise, right. wise, loading screen wise, it is broken.
Mm. I'm intrigued. Like, when did this come? I've literally only ever heard of this when you said it to me.
Same,
I know Phil Spencer brought it to us in Game Pass in our year of 2019.
You mean well, it came out last year. It came out on the PC early
brand
last,
new
year,
last year,
and it came out on the Xbox One in December. And people loved it on PC. Apparently, it's like awesome, but it's virtually unplayable on the Xbox. And I put about 15 hours into
is
this
it top
stupid
down?
Game.
Is it side scrolling?
No, it's first person shooter. It's, okay. It's quite rudimentary, but it's so moody and so weird. Scott, you'll love it actually, because it's so it raises so many philosophical questions, like dense philosophical thinkers, okay. And it just throws it at you and expects you to understand what it's talking about, and it's quite good, and it raises some really interesting moral standpoints, but it's just having to like wrangle all of its different systems because it is so obtuse and like unforgiving. But when you finish something, when you get to the end of a day and you've helped some people out, or you've done the unthinkable and pushed through this impossible scenario, it feels so good. It has this certain allure to it that even though I had to constantly stop and wait for the game to load every 20 seconds, like I wanted to keep playing it because it had something to it, and I hope to God that it gets fixed and go back and play it as it was intended to.
Can you give us something. One of those examples of a moral quandary?
A moral quandary. Okay, there's this one moment where essentially, there's this boy, and well, it's kind of like, would you kill a boy? Like, he throws it at you. There's this guy, this kid, who's got something you sort of need, and he's got this little gang of kids, and you can either help them or in hope to God that they repay you, or you can sort of just stab him to death. If you want to, you don't have to, but if you stab him to death, it'll help you out, because he's a kind of a little crap anyway, you know what I mean?
He's a little crap.
They're pickpockets, they're thieves, they will potentially murder you further on down the line. So
does anyone
like,
know that you've stabbed these little boys?
Well, that's it. You have like a
fallout
reputation.
Where everyone hates you.
It's not everyone hates you, but you have like a reputation meter that will go up or down. Okay. But it's cool, it's like how you want to administer medicine. That's probably a more nuanced one. I went for the really explicit one. But you've only got a certain amount of medicine. You can either give it to like the elites, which might ultimately help you stop the plague, or you can give it to the people you love, supposedly the people you like. So trying to, you know, please everyone on a limited amount of resources. It just works.
I tell you what, I'll throw in. This isn't something I've been playing recently, but Vampire, the one with Y, Vampire, that came out last year or the year before, that had, I can't even, Dr. Crane, I forget what you call the dude that you play as, but he's a doctor who becomes a vampire, and it's that idea of like, yeah, like trying to like playing as a character that can like that can help people by their very nature kind of thing. That's something that I don't think that many games explore, and it's like, yeah, how do you want to sort of spend your time, who do you want to save, like who do you want to bring back and stuff like that. To some degree, that's like, I don't know, something is more worthwhile than like, oh, I'm just gonna kill everybody.
Yeah,
like, trying to decide what's actually what good path you can take through the game.
Well, there's an interesting point where you have to go through these plague, like the more of the world map gets more infected the more you play, and you can go into like plague infested houses and you can essentially just rob them. But then there's people in there, babies kind of become currency. There are people looking for babies to sell because they think it'll make them better or whatever, so you have to sort of interact with that system.
How do you,
it's kind
you
of like
carry
this
them?
Is odd. You can put them in your backpack. You can drop them off at the town
it's
hall.
A video game.
Is this part of the like the new age of B games? Is this a B game, would you say?
It does feel like that, yeah. It's sort of, Vampire is a really good comparison. Okay. I think it's got on the same wavelength, whereas it's got some good ideas. It's got some really interesting mechanics. It's just nowhere near as polished as it needs to be.
You can trade babies.
You can trade babies. You can save the babies, my friend.
This seems like the biggest banter game ever, but I guess I will potentially check it out. It's on Game Pass.
It's on Game Pass.
It's on Benway's Game Pass.
It will make you infuriated when you hit these loading screens every 5 seconds. But I'm like, honest, I wanted to rip my own eyes out.
I sat through Bloodborne. It wasn't, you know.
This is worse.
Back in the day. Benway, you got through Sekiro.
Talk about a game worse than Bloodborne.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and a game that you can use these little baby items before you fight as well. There's little babies in it as well. Just really punishing myself.
We might do a separate podcast on Bloodborne versus Sekiro, but we'll see. For now, though, what are your thoughts on Sekiro? Have you spent your time well?
I really like the setting of Sekiro. I like the idea of the wolf, and I like a lot of things about Sekiro, but then I don't like the boss fights. Or I finally got over men with sticks, but then you get the little frog boys with
took
the massive hats
to get over that man with
who like to just jump up in the air and throw shurikens at you or poison you or something like that. And just like, it's like, I don't know why they perfected this series with Bloodborne, and then they went in what I think is a wrong direction here with Sekiro.
In terms of how much impetus they put on just like chip damagey stuff, and
I felt like most boss fights for me were chip damage the game. Like, there are a few which I feel like I could contend with men with big swords or beasts with big swords or actually probably the best boss I fought in that game was what's her name who flies around in the other world and she throws shurikens at you in the air.
Lady Butterfly?
Yes, Lady Butterfly. I thought that was one of the best bosses because you wasn't just being attacked by a giant thing or having to roll 400 times or block
right.
just to get out of the way of something hitting you.
The thing that I took up, because I went so far, like initially, I thought Sekiro was like so immaculate first. Then you fight Genichiro after, I don't know, 3-4 hours, maybe 6 hours.
Little arena as well can go and do one.
Yeah, there's bits and pieces. The thing is, like, it's obviously designed to frustrate. And I think the amount of player data that they've accrued over time, they are, like, you know, they can design a game that will push the human brain to its absolute limits in terms of memorization, timing, and reaction times. And everything. The weird thing is that I have to assume it's intentional is that for me, the biggest enemy when you finish Sekiro the whole time was you. It was your own patience. It was your own stress levels. And it's once you manage that and you cool down for each one of those bosses, where it's like, oh my God, like F this thing. And you sort of like reset yourself and steel yourself and you beat it. Like, not necessarily calmly, but you get through it. That feeling was like the greatest feeling in gaming. But it puts you through hell to get there.
I was in the last 17 of my spirit emblems. I was at the very end of my wits. I was like, I just need to be Lord Isshin. But like, after a while, I felt so bored getting past those first two stages because I could do them so quotes well, but then I'd get annoyed or bored and then get stabbed and then lose free healing things. Like, what am I doing?
Genichiro because I think we're talking about games being short. Even though it would have. If Sekiro had ended after the Genichiro fight, I think I would have adored it even more because it would have been this punchy, really focused thing. You have to steel yourself so much to beat Genichiro. And then for me, I remember back when we reviewed it and stuff, it only kind of went downhill after that because it could only repeat the same beats.
I like the water area, but then some of the enemies felt not cheap, but like they either throw things at you from a far distance or there's some guys that can spawn light. Sure, you can get the lightning counter. Or like the ones who take over your body. Mm. And like that really slowed it down for me. And it felt like funneling you in a game, which wasn't really funneling you for a lot of parts of it.
What did you come down on Sekiro overall?
I really liked it. I like Bloodborne more. I do agree that I think the longer it goes on, not the worse it gets, but my patience sort of was all gone by the end of it. I remember when you go back to the castle after everything's gone completely messed up and it's on fire and stuff.
I ran past everyone.
Me
I didn't
too.
Fight them.
At that point, I felt like the pacing was slightly off. I felt like I was getting to a natural conclusion and then it threw me another 5 hours, which sort of annoyed me. I do like all the stuff after Genichiro because I think up until that point, you are learning specific moves to fight specific enemies and then it's sort of a combination of everything. So like testing your skills. I will disagree though, Benroy, because for me, when it comes to the boss battles, I finally got what people love so much about Dark Souls and Bloodborne in that I had to actually learn the moves. I couldn't just be good enough or instinctive enough or responsive enough to dodge out of the way and then get a few lucky hits in. Like I eventually learned Dark Souls and Bloodborne, but I never felt like I had a mastery over them. Whereas in this, I felt like I had to learn the bosses, otherwise I would get absolutely rinsed.
With Bloodborne, I felt that, but like giant monkey thing, did any of you learn its moves or did you just have to run out of the way of its massive swings or its big
the second
of
phase
poo?
I think you can only run out the way.
See, the thing about that is that was a satisfying one because I thought that I would just have to run out the way and treat it differently. But when I realized I could, you know, regularly parry most of the big fist pounds, I was like, well, that's awesome. I've just been intimidated by the boss and assumed that I couldn't do it. But can do it,
yeah, that's
it's
my
like,
thing about stealing yourself. That's the thing. I mean, you can go through that whole game just perfecting when to push L1. You don't need anything else.
There were certain cues, like with the monk, the corrupted monk goes, before he does one swing. I'm just like, I hate you so much. Stop making that noise.
The thing that got me, and the first time, like I said, I really was like, oh my God, this game was the Genichiro fight. And you just got the lightning counter at that point. So I was like, and then by the time you realize in that fight, that you can fire the lightning back at him. I was like, this is an incredible like culmination of everything. It kind of repeats those beats like towards the end. I do think that like overall, it's strange because like you were saying about like that idea of memorization. Like in Sekiro, you'll only get through those fights when you know that the blocking rhythm is like da 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 da. Like once you've got that down, pressing L1, you'll be totally fine. But until you get that, you'll just keep getting chewed up. You have to beat the boss in the exact same way. You can use some items and abilities, but
until
for the
he
most
goes
part,
mad. The lightning, like, then I was pulling out my shield and doing the shield technique, like spinning around him and stabbing him in the side and stuff. But yeah, there were only a few bosses that I felt like I could proper learn it and like sort of contend with them, like Roberto Man, who you kick off the bridge and stuff.
Oh, he was great.
Yeah, I liked him in the end. So apart from when you would kick him, and then four times I kicked him into that pillar, and then just put the controller down, like, kill me.
I think it's like I said at the beginning of this point, like the way that they've focused all their player data to be like, this is exactly the, for me it felt like the limits of my like human abilities, like you know, to struggle through this thing.
I was sweating when I beat it. I was just, my hands were sweating.
Liquid man.
I remember when people came out, and you know, a lot of people who were veterans of Dark Souls and Bloodborne said that it wasn't really hard, whereas I got my ass kicked over and over again.
Everyone did. I realized, too.
Yeah. But it almost made me realize that I was playing Dark Souls and Bloodborne wrong, because even though I wasn't really getting killed by the end of those games, I was just sort of instinctively jumping out the way. I wasn't properly learning the attacks. I was learning what kind of attack is coming, and in a dodge usually sufficed no matter what it was. As long as they got the timing right, it was okay. Whereas here, you couldn't do that. You had to engage with the mechanics on their own terms, and there's something about that I really love.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
See, for me, the fact that you have to beat them in a certain way and they're going to do these animations over and over, that is more limiting to me. That's why I bounced off Cuphead. Because like Cuphead is like, memorize 45 minutes of an attack pattern and you'll breeze through it in like 5 minutes. You know, but it'll take 45 minutes of trial and error to memorize everything. That idea of challenge being memorization is something that I bounced the hell off. But I think that's the crux of it.
I feel like that's what some of the bosses, like, you can turn it into that, because Lord Ishin, is it Ishin?
Ishin's the last guy.
If you're a certain distance away, he'll always do his run jump attack, and you can always block it with a shield that I did. Mm-hmm. Or you can be up close and he does his big lad swings with a big stick, which I always hate. So like towards the end, I was just like, okay, if I go here, I know I'm going to trigger that attack. Or with Genichiro, like you can make him constantly do his lunge unblockable, but you don't even need to, you just walk to the side in one step and then just start hitting him.
Yeah,
and you can get him into that sort of weird loop.
That idea of like playing the AI though is the thing that Sekiro like wants you to do, whereas I think you can improvise your, like, I found so much more in Bloodborne and Dark Souls that I improvised my way through a fight first time and like just got through, and I was like breathing heavily and being like, man, like that was a great fight, and it felt like a fight. It felt like I had my tool set that I was improvising with and I beat this boss with, as opposed to in Sekiro it was almost like the Cuphead mentality of like, okay, it's a new boss, what do I have to memorize this time? And over time, that gets quite tiring.
Yeah, I would say there's a big distinction between the bosses and the regular enemies, because although each boss more or less proved a more difficult challenge for me, when it got to like the regular enemies, after about 10 hours or so, I felt like a lot of those I was breezing through, because I'd fought them before, I felt like I had a mastery over the skill set, and I could just kind of annihilate them, and it felt very satisfying
to get that
sort of power trip of, no, you know what, I've put my time and training in, I've gotten good at this parry mechanic, mm-hmm. and I'm absolutely going to wipe the floor with you until I get to the boss, who's then going to kill me.
I did until all the big men came in when the city was on fire, and you go around the corner, and you're behind this bit of like reeds, and you just see these two big lads fighting each other, and like they're barely doing any damage to each other. Right? Do I get involved with this, or do I just walk past every time?
Oh, see, so the mindset that I got over time, we'll move on to another game in a sec, but the mindset that I got into over time, when I saw things like that, I would feel that like, oh God, it's gonna suck learning this thing. But then I would just charge into it, because at that point I was like, I'd kind of resigned to the fact that the mentality they want you to have is, oh God, that's gonna suck, but I'll steal myself and do it anyway. Yeah. And like I said, I value that, but I haven't been back through Sekiro. And I haven't wanted to. Like, I've been back through. Don't do it. I'm not going to do it. I've been back through like Dark Souls 1 and 3. I've restarted 2. I've restarted Bloodborne. Sekiro was like, when it was done. And no part of me wanted to try it again.
It's going to sit on my shelf forever. If anyone wants it, then just give me the money and I'll send it to you.
I might play it again.
You will not play it again.
No. I might play it again.
You've got Pathologic, mate.
I'm not anymore. It's got the chop.
Now, I mentioned Deadly Premonition last week when I was on with Jules, and maybe you as well, JB.
Not me, but...
Someone was on in the
Ash.
Phantom. I think it was Ash. And we were talking about other games that we're playing and stuff. So Deadly Premonition is something I'm still going through, but I've already mentioned the fun, dumb stuff of that, and a cereal and jam sandwich that the man eats.
That's like the perfect game for the current like climate. You know what I mean? We've got nothing on, so let's play Deadly Premonition.
Let's watch a banter film.
Exactly.
A Hobbs and Shaw of gaming.
Yeah.
I wish I was playing that rather than Sekiro.
Yeah, you know, it's just as memorable. Deadly Premonition, still going through that. But my other big one is Arkham Origins. Arkham Origins and Blasphemous. Which of the two would you like to hear about?
Tell me about Blasphemous, because I on the day you bought this, I messaged you saying, Scott, should I buy Blasphemous? And you said, I'm going to buy it now.
Well, the thing is, you messaged me saying, should I get it? And I just finished the demo. So, like, weirdly, we were in sync. And I was like, man, it's really good. I know Jules loved it. He played it all last year. And he was forever telling us to get it. And we were like, yeah, whatever, 2D Dark Souls. Just finished Sekiro. Do not care. And so, like, didn't bother back then. But yeah, Blasphemous is brilliant. It's like, it is 2D Dark Souls in terms of the way the HUD's laid out and the fact that you're coming up against these, imposing enemies, the way the life bar, you got to, you know, like work your way through like a boss, like a really imposing boss and figure out how to, get them down and everything. But it's way snappier. It's because it is a side scroller. They play into the platforming aspects of it. They play into the way that it uses Metroid's or Castlevania's map system, where it's like block by block. Like, you bring up the map and it's like, okay, I've not been down here yet. So I guess there's some of the secret down there. Everything plays into everywhere else. Like, go get this key from here and unlock this other path. But it's mainly the way that it plays that's just brilliant. It's kind of like Sekiro has like an impetus on parries. But you also get a bunch of different power-ups that you can do, charge attacks and drop attacks, and different combos like combo extenders and stuff like that. One of the most fun things that I wish Sekiro kind of has this is fatalities for each enemy type.
Nice.
Because by the time you figure out how to beat them, it doesn't do them every time, it doesn't trigger every time. But sometimes, like, there's a guy right at the beginning that has a small guy with a shield, and he's always like battering you away with the shield. And the fatality on him is just to get his shield and squish him with it. And it's just great. Like, the idea that every enemy type has a specific fatality. You do that standard loop of like, you get battered by three or four of them at once, and then once you get used to it, it's like, bring it on. You deflect all of them in a row and you finish the last one with a really gory fatality, which this game is so absolutely, like, just as brutal as Mortal Kombat, ripping spines out and everything. It's brilliant.
I watched the trailer for it that day I messaged you, and I just thought the art style of it looked so like my crap, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
it's so macabre, that
sort of macabre high fantasy sort of thing compared with the graphic violence that's in
it. I'll tell you what, actually, which I've only just realized now as I'm thinking of it, the iconography of it is very much Bloodborne meets Souls.
Yeah.
Like, the whole story of it, you piece together the story through items and stuff, but it's mainly about this one sort of priest woman who stabs herself at the beginning with this like religious piece of this religious artifact thing and unleashes a bunch of sins and demons and stuff into the world. But the church symbol that she belongs to is like really close to the Bloodborne symbol or the Yharnam symbol, and they're clearly going for like right down the middle of like Dark Souls meets Bloodborne in a 2D setting. But yeah, that thing is just so snappy and so like just so satisfying. I burned through almost all of it in like a 6-hour stint and then had to take a break.
I'm looking forward to getting it.
It's really good. I mean, there's a free demo on the Switch if anyone wants to try it. But yeah, I absolutely adore Blasphemous. I don't know how you guys find like 2D versions of established formulas.
Well, this is it. I don't know about you, Ben Roy, but when I was looking at the gameplay for it, it's not usually something I would go for, but the aesthetic drew me in. That's not usually my kind of game, though.
I'm all right.
Good.
Yeah, you probably don't need this at this point in your life. Josh, you've been playing a lot of Red Dead 2.
I've been playing loads of Red Dead 2. This has been main game. Once I finished Pathologic 2, I needed a nice comfort. Well, I not even finished it. Gave up on it. I needed a comfort blanket. And I thought, you know what? We've got a couple of months without any big releases, so I'm going to play through this game because I might not get another chance. My schedule, my gaming schedule is never going to be as free as it currently is, and I thought it would be the perfect time because when I went through it the first time, even though I loved it, I didn't rush through it, but you want to see the end of the story, don't you? There's a drive to see
where it wants to go. Well, I
thought
I did until I got there, but yeah.
Shut up. I'll kill you. Yeah, so this time I've just been, you know, schmoozing my way through, playing cards at night with my team, doing dominoes. Is that how you're playing dominoes?
You can do some dominoes.
And just sort of chilling out, just drinking that game in because I've got the time and I've got the luxury to just, you know, wander the world and do all the side missions I passed over and all of the events that I didn't want to do because I wanted to get to the next story mission. And it's even better than before, like properly role-playing in that world, doing a lot of hunting, bringing it back to the camp. Even though mechanically your camp doesn't benefit from doing any of the upgrades or something, it's nice to do them, spend the time doing them and talking to the people around you and them appreciating it. That I spent so much more time back at the camp this time around, and you appreciate little character relationships and dynamics that I didn't the first time around. I always thought the jump for Sadie from being, you know, the crying, grieving widow to a genuine badass was always quite sharp. But here, if you sort of take a step back and you're just sort of wandering around and you look at her interacting with Abigail and sort of getting over that grief and then transforming it to someone else. The same with sort of Kieran and Sean and, I feel, the lady, there's a lady in it.
Molly?
No, I can't remember.
Sean?
Her name.
I don't know. It's 2 years ago.
Sean and the lady he likes. They have like a little romance that goes in the background. And when he goes, she grieves him and starts hitting the bottle and stuff. And all of those like subtle character developments that aren't front and center in the story just become apparent. And I thought that's so awesome. Like the attention to detail there to thread this story throughout this massive tapestry is just so fun to appreciate.
I remember thinking with that, like the camp scenes are like genuinely phenomenal. Like the amount of the way that they replicate like being at a house party or being at somewhere like a gathering where there's so much social chemistry going on and it feels like a bunch of humans interacting, which is sounds like a really easy thing to get right in theory, but like no other games made me feel like that.
It's nice to take just a big game like that, which we I think everyone was all playing just so we didn't get spoiled. Like let's get through this, get through this, get through this, and just breathe. Like when I'm doing that again, I'm like building roads and Death Stranding again, like just anything like that. Like you saying, realizing that these sort of moments between the characters are actually happening, but you're brushing through because you don't want to get someone like tweeting you online going, oh, by the way, so such and such dies, or this happens here, sort of thing.
Well, that's exactly it. Like the little missions, playing dominoes or doing the sort of character driven hunting or whatever, they all have little story beats to them. There was a time where I sat down to play a game at the camp with Abigail, and she talks to you about Mary, the girl Arthur fancies. And that's a little moment I didn't get the first time around, but then it makes that relationship even more impactful by the time you get the letter, by the time you go on the missions. Mm. And it's just those, they're not even throwaway lines of dialogue. They seem like they should be important.
Yeah.
But it just builds up a sort of sense of familiarity with these characters and who they are. And like Benroy said, it's just great to sort of take your time, go out and do whatever you want to do. Do some hunting, search for some treasure, come back, do some main missions, and then get to the end.
My thing, because the thing I love the most about Red Dead is those scenes. It's the little pockets of humanity in this really like kind of like destitute world. Like it's on the brink of like the end of the Old West and the beginning of society and judicial systems and Arthur and Dutch and that whole gang, that way of life doesn't belong. And he knows it. Like, you know, you read his diary and it's all these thoughts about him not even knowing where he's going to belong. And the way that story goes anyway kind of, you know, takes care of some things.
I just think it works so well knowing what happens. Like, there are moments all the way through, for instance, where you see Micah interacting with Dutch and you can see him getting into his head in the background, and he's just worming his way in to influence him and to take him down this dark path. Mm-hmm. And it's something that either you wouldn't notice the first time around because you're breezing through it, or you just wouldn't pay attention to because you don't know what it's building towards. But then it's the attention to detail in that game is just mad, man.
The thing that I was being really super facetious before, because the thing that I like, the Red Dead gave me the bad ending, which is the thing that I never got over. I was always like, well, what the hell? I thought I played him totally fine. I don't know why I got the bad ending. I just did. And so I never really unpacked that, but I've always wanted to go back through it because there is so much to that game. And even like the game's script is like some insane like stack of papers that they all had to get through. But it's good to know that like replaying it does kind of give you like a fresh perspective. There's a good reason to go back to it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it only gets better the second time around. The script anyway, like the mechanics, if you didn't care too much for them the first time around, you're not going to enjoy them this time. But you can cut a lot of the fat off. Like I said about the camp stuff, you can just, you know what you can focus on and what's going to reward you rather than just what's there for fluff, if that makes sense. So you don't have to do any of the badness.
Buy a new table.
I did. I actually got to deal Scott Tilford and Ben Roy. When I got the ingredients, Scott Table. Good. When I got the ingredients to make that red table at back of camp,
yeah,
to then play poker on it, I felt like I was part of something.
Red
it
dead
was,
table.
It was transcendent.
Having the most pride in your little, I don't know what it is, bearskin table.
Oh, I think it's a Proghorn one. I can't quite remember.
That's what the thing is. That's what they want you to do. They want you to do all that stuff so that it impacts the way the story goes, which is a beautiful idea, but I wish they pushed you into that stuff a bit more. But at the same time, because it is optional, it makes it work even more. Because, oh man, I put all this time in. Yeah. I did. And this thing happened anyway.
I guess it's kind of like me putting BB's theme on everything that I build now. So BB's theme is always, you know, you can put like...
In Death Stranding.
Yeah, in Death Stranding, you can put like music on all these things you build.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that.
Put the thing, the big dinosaur from Horizon Zero Dawn. Makes
those,
no sense.
Those moments are spot on, right? Because as gamers, we put a lot of stock into what rewards we're going to get for doing side missions or doing hunting and stuff. But often, it doesn't matter if it changes fundamentally the gameplay or the story. It's just how your story has changed, like how it's been personalized. And like you said, Benroy, you'll go through Death Stranding, you'll put that song on all the things you build, and that doesn't fundamentally change anything in the game, but it leaves an impact on you, it resonates more with you, just like my lovely little red table now is going to stay with me in my time with Red Dead Redemption, make
for
it
for a while
make it much more fond.
That's the way that David Cage justified drinking the orange juice in the fridge in Heavy Rain. He's like, well, you know you drank the orange juice. That was your character's day that morning, which, you know, makes some sense. And we will end on Benroy's favourite new game, Bioshock. You're living a bit here. Having a bit of the old Bioshock, aren't you?
Yes. This is a game I played Bioshock Infinite back in the day, you know, smashed it out in 11 straight hours pretty much. But Bioshock 1, never touched it.
It's on PS Plus at the minute.
Yeah, it was brought to us by PlayStation, so I thought, you know, I'd play it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think me and you are exactly the same on this.
That's a game which starts very strong. I love Rapture. And then you start realizing the combat's a bit naff. I mean, I don't know if it's 2007 combat or just in general,
it
that's why
it
is. Yeah, good. At least I got someone here, you're back in the day, who can reference this. And then, it's been in a billion lists. Shall I say the moment?
Everyone knows the moment.
Oh, everyone knows that.
After that, would you kindly moment? That would you kindly moment, which I've had support for me, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was super great leading up to that. And then it just goes on and on, and the game doesn't end, and the game decides to put turrets around every corner, and the game decides to put cameras around every corner, which then spawn flying little drones, which just shoot you. And by the end, every time I set an alarm off, I just put the controller down and let myself die, because I just realized it would be quicker for me to die.
Harakiri-ing yourself, just being like, just take me out.
And
I'm done.
I was running out of ammo, but what, you're trying to shoot these little buggers in the sky. So you know what? Nah, just... And just end me, and then everyone just being so powerful. I mean, like, the game does ramp up so much after that. And I was just kill me.
I think Bioshock is a humongous deal, and it's so obvious. Everyone knows this, that it's a big deal for what it did for video game storytelling and narrative and all that stuff. Yes, no one's taking anything away from that. I could never get on board with the combat. I hate fighting the big daddies.
Also, my audio logs wouldn't play after a while. Like, after that would you kindly moment, You would say, hold X to play it. No, I just won't play it. And I tried, and I was like, I'm not going into the menu to play this. So I missed out on so many audio logs for that game because they just won't play.
Oh,
and if you
shame.
Put that game in suspend mode, it also crashes.
Oh, good.
I tell you, the thing with Bioshock is that if it was a walking sim, if some fan had modded it, take out the combat, just make it a walking sim, I would have adored it.
Madness.
You shaking your head through a lot of that. What are you going to say?
I just love it, man. I all your criticisms are valid, especially about the turrets. They're so annoying, but I would say just hack them, Benroy. You
know, yeah,
a little blast of electric, hack them.
When I come around the corner and there's a bunch of like trash in the way, and then they're behind a little bit of bars, and you've got three or four splicer boys coming at you, and then someone shouting at you, you come here, and shooting you with a revolver. I'm just like, oh, so much going on, man.
I know what you mean. Like,
and then there's a camera, and then the little drones, and then I'm just put the controller down and die.
Yeah, he's dead then. He's done what he can.
It's one of those things where, for me, the world and the atmosphere just trumps everything in all of the bad things I don't like about that game. They're almost meaningless because of how good everything else
it
is.
It is so stellar.
It is everywhere else. I went back through the remastered collection as well, and I was actually surprised at how well it held up. The combat isn't anything spectacular, but I think it's punchy enough. And when I was going through it, it almost feels like a survival horror game in places, especially when you get to the dentist or some of those big set pieces. And it really is so well-paced, in my opinion, and spooky until you get to the end boss fight, who I will admit is just really bad.
Big old Fontaine.
You can get stunlocked in that as well, because like, if you don't buy, like, I went in there with two health kits because I thought I'll buy loads of ammo, there'd be health kits there. No, there's a health station, but I didn't have any ammo money left because I spent it all.
Well,
luckily there's one man with like 50 quid set off him, and I was literally spending it to deactivate, because there's a bit where he summons turrets after you stab him, shaking him the first time. I'm like, oh, you're not going to do this to me. You're not going to. And you can turn him off, but I had to find that money laying around. And just like, why would you give me those stupid I swore. Stupid turrets. Ken Levine, why did he do this to me?
It was a personal insult to you.
Don Mattrick get in his ear and go, charge him to get rid of the turrets. I'm just like, oh.
Are you going to play it through Bioshock 2? Because when I got the remaster collection, I had one of the best gaming weekends of my life. All my flatmates were gone, and I played through 1 and 2. Just
is it a band that you played Bioshock 2?
I am.
That's why.
He's too far gone.
Leave him.
Away.
I'm going to finish murdering everyone I can in Uncharted 1. Good. And then I'll maybe play it afterwards.
Good. Bioshock 2 is, I mean, it's destined to be that overlooked installment because it didn't have Ken Levine and stuff involved with it. But yeah, as a trilogy though, like if you haven't experienced Bioshock, you still should.
It's worth it.
Yeah. It's worth it for the storytelling and the characters and everything. So yeah, so that's all the different things that we've been playing at the minute. And we have a hashtag set up. Hashtag WCGP. Come leave us different comments, different questions, different things. And Bob's, and we'll dive into it going forward because, we might as well keep in touch in that. You there listening, why not? And so, yeah, come let us know what you think across on social media. But for now, this has been the World Culture Gaming Podcast, and I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
And Ben Roy Turner.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.